Chapter 9.
Is this some sort of joke?
Said Breck.
If it is not amusing.
Nikolai Racine is dead,
the ambimorph said.
But in a sense, he's also here. I have assumed his personality, his memories, his thought patterns, his bioplasm. And what you see before you is indistinguishable from the original, except it is not strictly human.
I don't believe it,
Stone said.
You were on Cassino with us. You haven't been out of our sight since we left. The transceivers
are stopgap measures, at best,
the Draconian said.
The transceiver implants prevented me from simply assuming any human form and attempting to enter your ground bases by passing myself off as human. They do not, however, prevent me from taking the place of a specific human if I am able to kill him.
How? I said.
We survive by assuming the forms of other creatures,
the Draconian said.
We duplicate them down to the last detail. In this manner, we are able to live as they live, possessing their interior organs, their biochemistry. We are able to adapt their life functions. We can breathe as they breathe, feed as they feed. Our adaptability has always been the key to our survival. But in what you would call our natural state, we feed in the same manner as the unicellular protozoans native to your planet.
You mean you absorb your food like an amoeba? I said. Suddenly, I understood, and I felt sick. My God, you ingested him.
You seem horrified, O'Toole,
said the Draconian.
And yet you humans saw nothing wrong with hunting us for food. In the form we had adopted, we were even considered something of a delicacy by many of those who first came here, which is more than I can say for the taste of human flesh. I became quite ill after consuming Razine. It is an experience I have no wish to repeat, so you can rest easy on that count.
The shape-changer grimaced wryly.
I promise not to eat you. I killed Razine only because it was necessary. He tried to kill me. Consuming him was the only way I could absorb his transceiver implant into my own system.
Then you've broken the quarantine, said Breck. But by telling us, you have also alerted our authorities.
Which was precisely my intention,
the Draconian said.
I have no wish to harm you. You are my vehicles for communicating with the human race through your psych fidelity network. I am aware that your player master, Tolliver Mondego, is monitoring your experience along with officials of the Draconis Combine. Mr. Mondego, I have information which will be of vital interest to the human race, but I shall divulge none of it unless I have your assurance that this transmission will not be interfered with by the Combine. I await your reply.
I held my breath, waiting for Mondego's contact. It did not come right away. The tension increased as the silence lengthened. Finally, Mondego's voice came to us across the vast distance of space.
Forgive me, delay,
he said, his well-bottomed voice sounding, in my mind, perfectly calm and controlled.
It was necessary to have the Combine Observer removed from the game control center. He became quite agitated and wanted to censor the transmission, indicating it would cause widespread panic. He may be right, but under the circumstances, I feel that I must override him on the grounds the public's right to know.
I didn't think Mondego was especially concerned about the public's right to know, but the ratings would definitely be on his mind. He was speaking to the telepathic shape-changer directly through us.
You have my assurance that there will be absolutely no interference with the transmission of the player's experience. Your message will be broadcast live over the Sci-Fi Network, for which I accept full responsibility. In return, I trust you will remember your promise not to harm my players. Now, what is it you want?
I was surprised by Mondego's apparent concern for our welfare, until I realized that he was probably not speaking for our benefit alone, as he usually did, but for broadcast purposes as well.
We want only to survive,
said the shape-changer.
We draconians, as you call us, do not wish to be perceived as dangerous, xenophobic monsters, and we are all too aware that we will probably be portrayed in that light. When you humans first arrived here, we did not engage in any hostilities against you. We were peaceful, till humans began to kill us indiscriminately, to hunt us for food. We were forced to act in a manner that would ensure our survival, which has always been dependent on our ability to assume what you would call protective coloration, to adapt to our environment. When confronted by a predator, it is our first instinct to take that at first, merely to protect ourselves, but also to learn everything we could about this new predator, which had appeared. The result was a form of mutation for which, in a curious way, we should probably thank you. You are the most advanced species we have ever encountered, and through our defensive transmogrification into human form, we evolved into something much more than what we were. We understood that, to you, we were initially nothing more than animals, and that it was not unnatural for your predatory instincts to cause you to act as you did. We also understood that among many of you, there was considerable regret for your mistake. Yet, while there may have been said regret, there was also fear. Fear, which would have led to the genocide of our species, only our nature renders us difficult to detect. Mr. Breck, as one of the soldiers sent here for that purpose some time ago, can testify to that. A quarantine was the only logical alternative,
the shape-changer continued.
But there's something here you humans wanted, and a quarantine, a real quarantine, would have denied you access to it. Fire crystal means nothing to us. We have no use for it. We would gladly have given you all you wanted, but you chose instead to come and take it for yourselves, as if it were your right to do so. We would have not have objected to that either. Only your greed caused you to come here and kill one another for it, and your fear caused you to kill us as well. If you had your way, you would have wiped us out, not just because you were afraid of us, but because this planet could be terraformed and we were in the way. You have done this, even with those of your own kind. Well, we have learned much from you, and one of the things we have learned is how to deal with you in terms you would understand. We want no more humans on our world. You may keep your ground bases and use them to negotiate with us for Fire Crystal. You may think of them as embassies. But we do not want you to set foot beyond the confines of those ground bases, and we will not give you Fire Crystal for nothing. We have learned that humans value only that which costs them dearly. And to strengthen our negotiating position, we will appeal to your fear. We have broken your quarantine. We succeeded in breaking it some time ago. The method is not a very pleasant one for us, but it has proven effective. Even as I speak, some of us are out in Casino and the other habitats which comprise the Fire Islands. Some of us has gone onto your colonies and even to your home world, Earth, where we can easily pass as human and where just as easily. we can reproduce. We can live among you peacefully as humans,
the shape-changer said.
Even as there are now humans living peacefully with us, trapped here by your own quarantine. Or we can embark upon a series of terrorism, the like of which your world has never seen before. It is not something we wish to do, but you have shown us how, and we are uniquely suited to it. The choice is yours. We have had enough of being slaughtered. That is all I have to say. I have now accomplished what I had set out to do.
The Draconian looked at each of us in turn, gauging our reactions, as if he were trying to guess from our thoughts how the rest of the human race would respond upon hearing this ultimatum. Breck stood looking at him. He walked over to the crystal formation, removing his glove as he went, snicked out his blades, and struck the formation a sharp blow at the bottom of a cluster. An obelisk-shaped crystal broke off and dropped into his other hand. He held it up briefly and looked at the fires dancing within the perfectly formed natural facets.
"We have also accomplished what we set out to do," he said. "Now, we had best be on our way."
The shape-changer hesitated a moment, then nodded and holstered his pistol.
"I will take you back."
"I would not advise that,"
Breck said.
"You have delivered an ultimatum that will not be received easily or well. If the Combine's representative had time to get off a tachyon transmission to Cassino, you will never leave the ground base alive. They will want to interrogate you thoroughly, and they will not be particular about how they get their answers."
"It is a risk I was prepared to take,"
the Draconian said.
"Someone needs to represent our case to your people."
"What if our people decide to kill you?"
Stone said. The Draconian gave a very human shrug. Part of me was wondering why we were concerned about his safety. This alien had just threatened the human race with terrorism. Yet another part of me, the part I tried to focus on, was reminding me that we were the aliens here and that we had been the ones who taught him. I tried to imagine how I would have felt if the Draconians had come to Earth to claim it for their own. How would I have felt if they had considered us nothing more than animals? What would my reaction have been if they had started hunting us for food? Would I have been content to have them quarantine my world? One of the first and most important steps in any conflict in our history was always the dehumanization of the enemy. What follows here is a list of slurs. So if you don't want to hear that, skip forward 20 seconds. An Indian became a Wog. A Native American became a Redskin. An Asian became a Nip. A Gook. A Chink. A Kraut. A Kike. Wop. Spick. The N-word. Thank God that's over. Back to the story. It was all the same. One category, one subrace, one something less than human, which made it easier to oppress or even kill. In this case, it was really easy because there was no question of humanity involved. This time, we were really faced with other, and the emotions brought into play keyed off us and them. Part of me was emotionally outraged at the Draconians' belligerence, and part of me kept pulling in the reins, reminding me that we had taught them this.
"We have learned how to deal with you in terms you would understand,"
the Draconian had said. It was infuriating to be told what terms we would understand. It sounded arrogant and condescending. How was it possible to dispute knowledge gained through telepathic contact? How could it be dismissed as arrogance? What was arrogant was that we had imposed our sensibilities and our perceptions upon another race of beings. We'd even had the arrogance to name them after the human who had discovered their world. And then there was the question of responsibility. By coming to their planet, we had changed them. Our interaction with them had forced a mutation. They had learned, been forced to learn, to become like us, to look like us, and act like us, and think like us. I looked at Racine and saw the Racine that had been the human template for the new model I confronted. The mimicry was perfect, both inside and out. Inside the chest, there was now a heart that beat just like a human heart, lungs that breathed like human lungs. Cut him and he might bleed. Would a mechanical analysis reveal a composition unlike that of human blood? Or is this so plastic a life form that even the molecular structure of human blood could be duplicated? Could they even be what they were if their molecular structure were not plastic, radically different from anything we had ever encountered before? How much was really known about them? Did they merely take the form of humans, or did they, in fact, become human? If so, then maybe they were better at it than we were. The real Nikolai Racine would probably have killed his enemy. This one had chosen not to. None of us spoke as we made our way back through the tunnel to the cavern where we had left the skimmer. There was a lot to think about. Our experience had become much more than simply an entertainment for the masses. I'd wonder how the news would be received back home. I thought I had a pretty good idea of the answer, and that made me afraid. Breck and the Draconian were in the lead. Stone walked directly ahead of me. I suddenly felt an overpowering need to reestablish the closeness there had been between us. I reached out and took her by the arm. She stopped and turned to face me for a moment. In the darkness of the tunnel, we could barely see each other.
"Stone,"
I said, speaking in a voice not much louder than a whisper.
"I just wanted to say about what I said back in Casino."
I felt her fingers briefly touch my lips, and then, a moment later, I felt her lips brush mine. Then she turned and continued down the tunnel. That soft contact, so brief, and yet so full of meaning, was more important to me than anything we could have said to one another. Sometimes there are things you have to say that can't be said with words. I wondered if paranoia was a trait unique to humans. It was hard enough among yourselves to develop trust. It was hard enough to believe in someone. Does this person really think well of me? Are these people really my friends? Do they really like me? Does she really love me? Does he really understand me? Or is it some secret truth being kept from me? What is he really thinking? What does she really want? Wasn't what psychologists called being well-adjusted actually nothing more than a functioning methodology for dealing with our insecurities? How well-adjusted would we be now, knowing we had been invaded? To all those other questions directed at seeking reassurance would now be added a terrifying further doubt. Is this person really human? And how would anybody really know? We reached the end of the tunnel and stepped out into the giant cavern. The skimmer sat on the ledge just below us. I wanted to believe that none of it had really happened. We had come here to obtain a chunk of fire crystal, and we had done that. Now we would leave. Would the game go on as before? I didn't like the rule changes. I didn't want to play. I wanted to yell out that universal, wonderful, childlike demand, "Do over!" It was an unacceptable reality. I didn't want to deal with this. We were almost to the skimmer when the shots were fired. The first plasma blast slammed into a rock formation just in front of us, between us and the skimmer. Superheated rock chips and chunks of molten crystal flew like shrapnel. The second one, coming fast on the heels of the first, blasted the cavern wall above to the left. The entire wall came down in an avalanche of rock and dust. Something struck me and I went down. I heard someone shouting, but it was drowned out in the echoes of the plasma bolts and falling rocks. I covered my head with my arms, expecting at any moment to be crushed beneath tons of rock. I was dazed. There was a ringing in my ears. I wasn't sure how much time had passed, if I had lost consciousness or not. I felt the wetness in my eyes before I felt the pain. Blood was trickling down from a gash in my forehead, above my left eyebrow. My right shoulder felt numb. Rock and crystal dust was everywhere. I tried to breathe, and it triggered off a spasm of coughing. The first thing I saw as the dust slowly settled was the skimmer, half on and half off the ledge, crushed beneath fallen boulders. I couldn't see any of the others. There was a huge pile of rubble in front of me. I had just missed being buried beneath the stone.
"Stone!"
Breck came scrambling toward me over the mound of rubble.
A tool! Here!
I said, coughing and struggling to my hands and knees, wiping blood out of my eyes.
Stone!
She's alive,
he said. He didn't look well.
She didn't quite make it clear, but I was able to pull her free. Both her legs are broken. She had some cuts and bruises, possibly internal injuries. I cannot be certain.
The Draconian?
Breck looked over his shoulder at the pile of rock.
Under there.
What happened?
I said.
Who?
Cameron,
said Breck.
Who else?
Racine!
Someone shouted.
Racine, you alive?
The voice echoed weirdly in the cavern.
O'Toole! Breck!
Breck glanced at me and shook his head.
Make no sound,
he said, drawing his weapon.
Racine! You're alive! Just answer me, boy!
The voice had to be Cameron's.
Move,
Breck said softly.
Is anything broken?
I don't know. I think I might have a concussion. I can't move my right arm, but I think I can walk.
Stone needs help,
said Breck.
The only way we can leave here now is with their schema. Ot or them. They made the choice. You understand?
I nodded.
What do you want me to do?
Get over there with Stone,
said Breck.
Try to keep them occupied while I work around behind them. Can you make it?
I'll make it.
Good man.
He clapped me on the shoulder, giving it a hard squeeze.
Rudy?
I swallowed hard.
What do we do if you don't come back?
I will be back,
Breck said. I smiled weakly.
Promise?
I promise.
I crawled around the mound of rubble piled before me, under which the Draconian was buried. I wondered what would happen now. I found Stone in the shelter of a large stalagmite where Breck had left her, her back propped up against it. She held a plasma pistol in her hand. The expression on my face must have said it all, because she grimaced at me wryly, clearly fighting back pain, and said,
"Sorry, didn't have time to fix myself back up."
Her face was caked with blood and rock dust, and her matted hair hung down in her eyes. She made no move to brush it away as she reclined against the rock, breathing heavily. She shut her eyes tightly, grimacing with pain. Her legs were splayed out at odd angles. There had been no time for Breck to splint them, nothing to splint them with. I took her hand and she squeezed hard.
I guess we blew it,
she said, gritting her teeth.
Not yet we didn't. It isn't over till it's over.
She managed a small grin.
It isn't over till it's over. I like that. Did you just make it up?
It's something my father always used to say. I never knew if it made any sense or not until I started playing cards for money.
Well,
she said, gasping with pain.
I can't say if I care much for this hand. You're the gambler. What do you suggest?
We can't afford to fold. We'll have to bluff. Only in this case, we make them think we're holding even worse cards than we are. With any luck, her partner will slip us an ace or two under the table.
What happens if they call him at it?
I shrugged.
That's why they call it gambling.
I see. Remind me not to play poker with you.
Cameron!
I shouted, trying to make my voice sound as if I had been badly hurt. I didn't have to try too hard.
O'Toole! Yeah! Don't shoot! Please! Where's Rusty? Dead! So's Breck! They were both buried when the wall came down! Stone's hurt real bad! She's unconscious! She may be dying! I can't move! My legs are broken! I'll do anything you want! Just don't kill me! Please! I'll tell you where the fire crystals are! That's what you want, isn't it?
I heard him laugh. It was a very unpleasant sound.
What's so goddamn funny? You don't have anything to bother me, O'Toole. Look above it.
I glanced up to where the wall of rock had come down, burying the Draconian. The avalanche caused by the plasma blast had exposed a face of shimmering crystal, a thick vein of faceted clusters glowing with a lambent inner fire of dazzling colors.
I just broke it, Rachel, too!
Cameron's voice came back, echoing off the walls.
I do proceed completely to it. This whole cabin will be full of fire crystal. There's enough here for a man to buy his own damn planet. What happens to us?
I shouted back.
What about Smiley Davies and the others? Funny thing about that.
Cameron called back. He sounded closer. So, that was why the Draconian had led us through the tunnel to the surface. If the cavern was full of fire crystal, there was no need for us to hike up to the caldera. But he wanted to be certain his message would get through. We couldn't broadcast from inside the cavern.
Cameron!
I shouted, holding my weapon ready. It sounded as if he was trying to work his way up to us. I glanced at Stone, put my finger to my lips, and pointed to where I thought he was coming from. Then, I pointed at the mound of rubble, thinking if I could get him up above it, I might get a clear shot at him. Stone nodded that she understood.
Cameron! Please! I'll do anything! I don't want to die! Sorry, O'Toole, that's the way it goes!
I started to crawl toward the mound of rubble.
Toss out your weapons, O'Toole! I'll make it quick and painless!
I started to drag myself up the mound of rubble. I grabbed hold of a rock and started to pull myself up. But it came loose and started a small slide, taking me down with it. It broke other rocks loose and they cascaded down over the ledge, starting a small avalanche down into the bottom of the cavern. I almost went over with it. I caught myself just in time.
It'll never work, O'Toole!
Yelled Cameron.
I know exactly where you are! Give it up!
A large part of the rubble mound had broken loose and fallen over the edge. I was in the open, an easy target. A fact that was confirmed when a plasma flash plowed by so close to me that I felt the heat wash past me, and the rocks I was clinging to suddenly grew very warm to the touch. The rocks started to slide again, and I scrambled for purchase. I was obscured by the shower of rock chips and dust.
You want it the hard way, O'Toole?
Cameron shouted from somewhere below me. I cursed Breck. Where in the hell was he? Stone was on the other side of the mound of rubble and couldn't cover me from there. I was completely exposed, unable to fire. If I let go even for an instant, I was sure to slide down over the edge, and it was a long drop to the bottom.
Say goodbye, O'Toole,
I heard Cameron say from behind me. I heard a plasma pistol fire and wondered what it would feel like to be incinerated, but the hellfire never came. I glanced quickly over my shoulder and caught a glimpse of something wreathed in blue flame falling down into the abyss below me. It was a moment before I realized it was Cameron.
Hey, come on, O'Toole!
Shouted Breck from somewhere off to my right. I shut my eyes and pressed my face against the rock, clinging to it like a bug to a wall, and hoping it wouldn't start sliding again. I had nothing left. That look down into the abyss and the sight of Cameron's burning body falling, tumbling end over end, had taken all the fight right out of me. I'd been ready to die and had resigned myself to it, but miraculously, my death had been postponed. It left me feeling giddy, wanting to sob with relief. I heard rocks skittering down as Breck came closer, moving carefully. I began to believe the man was indestructible.
Easy, O'Toole,
Breck said.
Give me your hand, or must I pull you up by your hair?
The crazy image of Breck hauling me up by the hair, like some sort of caveman with his latest conquest, made me chuckle in spite of myself, and it broke the freeze. Cautiously, I extended my hand to him. I felt his gloved, nice steel fingers clamp around my wrist like a vice, and suddenly I was being pulled up effortlessly, as if I didn't weigh a thing. Rocks started to slide under me, but Breck held me firmly in his grasp, and a moment later, I was pulled to safety.
I found the skimmer,
Breck said.
That bastard actually had the nerve to follow Racine in. There's no sign of the others. I, zinc he must have done for them.
I nodded.
Are you all right?
I took a deep breath.
I thought I was a dead man back there.
You almost were. All things considered, I thought you handled yourself rather well.
You know,
I said,
this is going to sound crazy, but for a moment there, while I was clinging to the rocks, wondering if Cameron was going to get me first or if another slide would dump me over the edge, I had the wildest temptation to just let go.
Breck nodded.
The magnetic attraction of fear. I am told it literally pulls at you. It can be quite seductive.
That's what it felt like, sort of pulling.
But you did not give in to it.
I don't know why. Too scared, I guess. Scared to let go.
Clinging to life,
said Breck.
I envy you the intensity of that experience. Sometimes I wish I knew what it was like to feel afraid. Do you feel euphoric now?
Yes, I suppose I do. I don't know whether to laugh or cry. I'm trembling. How do you feel?
Breck sighed.
Very. And savagely bitter.
He looked at the pile of rock beneath which the draconian was buried.
That poor creature never had a chance. You know what will happen now?
I shook my head.
We are going to finish what we started here, the humans,
Breck said.
And my friend, Bill Wren, is going to be the man saddled with the job. No one will look at what the draconians have done as self-defense. It will be considered an invasion, and we shall react accordingly. What a waste. What a damnable criminal waste.
Maybe we can do something,
I said.
Perhaps,
said Breck.
But I cannot see how. In any case, we first have to figure out how to get out of here. Can you fly a schema?
I stared at him with a sinking feeling in my stomach.
No. Can't you?
I have never flown one of these small civilian models,
he said. He shrugged.
What the hell? How different can it be?
I think I'm going to be ill,
I said.
In that case, do it and get it over with. I will need your help to carry Stone. I am not about to hike out of here with both of you on my back.
Okay, give me a second.
I turned around, leaned forward, supporting myself on a stalagmite, and emptied out my guts. It made me feel better, though I still felt a little lightheaded. When I was finished, I looked up and my gaze fell upon the shimmering vein of fire crystal exposed by the plasma blast from Cameron's gun. The clusters gave off light in thousands of directions. The fires danced within them, giving the illusion that the crystals were filled with multicolored lights pulsing through them. I was staring at a fortune. All I had to do was break off a few chunks and fill my pockets, and I would have enough to set me up for life. Enough to buy off Sakara if he would not be bought off. Enough to pay battalions of ninjas for his assassination. But I couldn't reach the vein. I was on the other side of the chasm in the rock slide it had been exposed by, which had rained down on the ledge where we stood and crushed our skimmer and buried the draconian. It also blocked off the entrance to the tunnel leading up to the caldera. Cameron had said the cavern was full of crystal. We could undoubtedly find more. But strangely enough, perhaps irrationally, I didn't care. I'd yet to touch a fire crystal, and now I didn't want to. I was suddenly afraid that if I held one in my hand, something would happen to me. The dancing fires within the crystal had a hypnotic beauty that was now completely lost on me. But if I actually touched them, they might burn me with their cold flame and ignite something within me that would turn me into someone just like Cameron. That scared the hell out of me.
Some people are players,
Sean O'Toole had told me once.
And some people are blade. If you ever find yourself standing at a wheel, watching the ball going round and round, unable to take your eyes off the bloody thing as if that were your heart bouncing around down there, or if you're ever standing and sitting at a table with your steak reduced to eating money, holding a handful of nothing, and you know you have to throw them down and leave, but somehow you can't bring yourself to do it, then you'll know you've got the fever, and it's not you holding the cards, but the other way around. If that ever happens to you, son, then you'll know what you should never, ever play again. Take your lumps and drag yourself away. And if ever anyone asks you to sit down to a game again, then shoot the bloody bastard, because he'll be asking you to hang yourself.
I was a player, a man who was used to taking risks. But a real player knew when to cut his losses and walk away. I looked down over the edge into the chasm where Cameron had cashed in his chips. And then I started walking. End of chapter.